Lecture 3, Consideration, Capacity, and Form.
Greetings. This topic is called Consideration, Capacity, and Form. These are three elements of a contract. We talked about consideration and capacity, or required minimums of a contract, and form, that is, what form it is in, is a requirement on some contracts. The first topic is consideration. We already talked about how some form of consideration is required, but I didn't tell you too much about what consideration was other than it's usually money or something of value. So that's what we're talking about here. There are two key elements to consideration. The first one is usually called detriment. While you think of a contract as people getting things, it's also, of course, people giving something up. So it's considered consideration if it is a detriment to me to give it up to you, and you give me something that's a detriment to you. Don't look so much at the gain to one side as the detriment to the other. So detriment means that for there to be a contract, I have to give you consideration, and that means giving you something to my detriment. Obviously, if I give you money, that's to my detriment because otherwise I could spend it. Now, the key fact here is that detriment is considered to be something of legal value, but not necessarily of monetary value. For example, suppose you contracted to buy the Tampa Bay Buccaneers football team. After you bought them, you owned them for a year or two, and you say, this team is of no value. They are not of monetary value. They're not of football value. I got nothing of value when I got the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Therefore, this contract cannot possibly... Sorry, folks in Florida, pick another team. This could not possibly be a contract. There was no consideration. I got no value. I got no value for my dollar. No, that's not what we're talking about. Whether if you buy something, if you buy a losing business, you still have consideration because you got something of legal value. It may not have happened to be of monetary value as time passed, but it was of legal value. It gave you the legal right to run that team, to hire and fire coaches and players and do whatever else you wanted to do. And that legal value is all that's required. The most famous consideration case of all time is another old one. Every law student has probably read this case and knows it by heart. It's called Hammer or Hamer. Professors haven't quite decided how to pronounce it. I don't know if he did. But I call it Hammer v. Sidway. Now, here we had an uncle who was most fond of his nephew. And he wanted to give his nephew something, but he also wanted to help his nephew. So he made a contract where he agreed to give his nephew a monetary stipend, a certain amount of money, when his nephew reached age 21. Well, that was his consideration, giving up the monetary stipend. What supposedly was the nephew's consideration? The nephew's part of the deal was that he had to forswear gambling, smoking, and swearing, I think. Maybe drinking, too. Anyway, that sort of thing. He was giving up all of that sort of thing until he was 21. And in exchange for that, he was going to get this... It left him a little fun. But in exchange for that, he was going to get this monetary grant when he gets to be 21. So the nephew, you know, being a good boy, followed the terms of the contract religiously. He didn't drink. Never swore. You know, never gambled. All that. So he turns 21, and he wants his money. Well, it happens that the uncle has passed on. And so now the money is in the hands of the uncle's estate, and the administrator of the estate, which would be okay. They're still supposed to pay him, right? Except the estate, not being so friendly toward the nephew, I suppose, as was the uncle, refuses to pay. And the estate's theory is that the nephew, gave up nothing to his detriment. In other words, that he benefited from not drinking, swearing, gambling, etc. This was to his advantage. He is a better person today for not having done this. So he gave up nothing of detriment. So there was no consideration, so there's no contract, so we don't have to pay. The court said, no. We're not going to make judgment calls over what people should do or shouldn't do. He gave up the nephew gave up a legal right, I guess. At the time, he had a legal right to gamble. He certainly had a legal right to swear, smoke, whatever. So he gave up something to his detriment. Now, he may have benefited from giving it up, just like someone might benefit from selling a losing business. But it's still a detriment. He gave up a legal right, which is of legal value, so it is a contract. So, fortunately, the nephew gets the money. And then probably spend it all on gambling and smoking. I don't know. I don't know. They don't tell you that. Okay, what else? Altruism. This is the law again. We don't have to tune into altruism. Altruism is not considered relevant consideration under the law. So if I were to give money, if I see a fine, upstanding person and I say, "You look like someone who needs money, who could use money, and I will benefit greatly by feeling like I helped another person by giving you this money, so I promise to give you so much money." Is there any consideration there? No. The other person gave up nothing of detriment. So just altruism doesn't suffice for consideration for a contract. But you don't look to the actual motive. You don't look to the actual motive. Suppose I want to give a gift to a friend of mine. Now, I could just say I'll give you $5,000. That, of course, would be a gift and would not be enforceable. Or I could make a contract whereby I agree to buy his car for about $5,000 more than it's worth. You know, he's giving me the car, I'm paying $5,000. It's functionally the same thing. I'm functionally giving him $5,000. But there it's in a contract form, because he is giving up something of detriment. That's his car. He is. And I'm giving up something of detriment, certainly. I'm giving money. So that is a contract, even though it has the same substantive effect, probably, as giving him a $5,000 gift. And the courts aren't going to look to my motive. They're not going to ask, "Well, didn't you really mean to make it just a gift, in which case it's not enforceable?" This is one where if it looks like consideration, if it quacks like consideration, it's consideration. Okay, so detriment. Now, there's a second part to consideration. It's not enough for both sides to give up detriment. It also must be bargained for detriment. It has to be an exchange. This is crucial to contract consideration. There must be an exchange. Well, now, you might just be thinking, well, if two people give detriments to one another, it's obviously an exchange, right? Not necessarily. Think about Christmas. You're with your family at Christmas. What happens? You give presents to your relatives. Your relatives give presents to you. Is this a contract? Is this consideration? Could I sue my sister if she doesn't give me any presents? Probably not. Because see, here, while there is detriment, you know, both sides are giving gifts, detriment. Their gifts are not in exchange for one another. Well, if you have a particularly mercenary family, perhaps they are. But they're not really in exchange for one another, so it's not a mutually bargained for exchange detriment, and therefore it's not consideration, and it's not a contract. Although a clever lawyer could probably make Christmas into an implied contract based upon a course of past dealing. But generally not. Okay, here's another one on bargain for. Suppose I agree to give you my car if you come over and pick it up. Is that consideration? Is that a contract? Well, I'm giving up something of detriment. That is my car. You're giving up something of detriment in the sense of your time to come over and pick up my car. So does that make it a contract? Probably not. Because I'm not bargaining for your detriment. I'm not making this contract to give you my car so I can get you to come over. That's just the means by which you pick it up. I'm not bargaining for that. Now, it could be different. We could change the facts. I could say, "I'll give you my car, Lena Olin, if you come over and pick it up." In that case, I assure you I am bargaining for her coming over to my house. And then it might be consideration and it might be a contract. You have to look at all the facts. Okay, so considerations, you know, a long-standing traditional rule of contracts. hasn't produced a lot of litigation because usually it's taken care of. I mean, that's why people make contracts customarily, is for consideration. If it weren't for consideration, people wouldn't even make them. So most contracts have it. Some circumstances, though, a problem arises. One of these is called the pre-existing duty rule. The pre-existing duty rule. It's not consideration if you agree to give up something of detriment that you are under a pre-existing legal duty or contractual duty to do anyway. Let's say you're an employer, and you have been suffering some thefts from your office. So you make contracts with all of your workers where you agree to pay them $100 extra a month if they don't steal anything. Well, in a way, there's, you know, some detriment there. You're paying $100 and they're suffering the detriment of not stealing. But that's not their part in this is not considered consideration because they're already under a duty not to steal. Likewise, if you have a contract duty to do something, you can't generally expect more money to do something that's already your duty. The UCC, though, the Uniform Commercial Code, changes this for goods, for whatever reason. If, suppose, I have a contract with you, and under the terms of my contract, I am paying you $10,000 for 1,000 widgets, okay? Now, it happens that the market cost of producing widgets goes way up. So you come back to me and say, look, there's no way I can get you those 1,000 widgets for $10,000. I'll go broke. I'll go out of business. If I were a good, hard-hearted type, I'd say, oh, I don't care if you go broke. I don't care if you go out of business. I want those widgets for $10,000, and I'm going to sue you if you don't provide them. But maybe I'm not so tough. Maybe I value you as a continuing business relationship. In that case, I might say, well, I've been reading about widgets in Business Week. I understand. I tell you what. I'll pay you $15,000. I understand you need the extra stipend to produce them, so I'll pay you $15,000. Now, see, under the traditional old-fashioned pre-existing duty rule, I don't have to pay you $10,000, even if I said that, because that extra $5,000 had no consideration. You were already obligated to do it for $10,000, so the extra $5,000 is like a gift that the law won't enforce. But that's under the old common law rule. Which that old common law rule, remember, applies to many contracts for services, things that are not goods covered by the UCC. Under the UCC, however, that modification, that extra $5,000, is a binding contract. It's just a rule. The UCC says, we're getting rid of the pre-existing duty rule here. We'll call it a binding contract. So it's a binding contract. So the UCC allows a little room for friendliness in business dealings, I guess. That's nice. Makes it easier to be a nice guy in business. But in other contracts, the pre-existing duty rule still applies. I tell you, one time when the pre-existing duty rule is most likely to be found is where there is a debt to be settled. Say I owe you $10,000, and it's clear that I owe you $10,000, and I say, will you take $5,000, and call it, you know, just a deal? Well, you might be tempted to say yes, just to get your money. But then suppose you take the $5,000 and you sue me for the other $5,000. And I say, hey, you can't do that. We had a deal for $5,000. What would your answer be? The pre-existing duty rule. There you go. Your answer would be, I got no consideration for that $5,000 reduction in the debt, so I should be able to sue for that $5,000. The way the law deals with this generally is it looks to see if the amount of the debt is debatable. In other words, do I have a plausible claim that I only owe you $4,000 or $5,000? If I do, then it'll say the compromise was a legitimate compromise. I mean, it was unclear if I really owed you $10,000. So, however, if it is crystal clear beyond dispute that I owe you $10,000, then that modification, that compromise, may be unenforceable. And you can still sue me. This happens sometimes when people write. You'll get a check, maybe, and people will say, in full satisfaction of all debts. Well, you might need to take some care about cashing that check, because if you cash it, you may be giving up your right to sue on debts over and above the amount of that check, depending on whether it's the law calls it liquidated or unliquidated. Liquidated is where it's, you know, finally in a court judgment such as something like that, so there's no doubt. Unliquidated is where it's in dispute. But if it's an unliquidated debt and you take a check for a reasonable amount claiming to be in full payment, it is in full payment, you can't go back and collect the rest. See, you know, when you get a check, you always want to cash it, but you may have to be careful there. Okay, that's the pre-existing duty rule. Next, we'll talk about illusory consideration. Illusory consideration. This sometimes comes up. This is where a party might appear to be giving up something, but is not really, is not truly committing to something, can readily back out of the contract. You're going to sell me widgets, and we make a contract, and the terms of our contract are, I agree to buy widgets from you at $10 a widget in the quantity of however many I want. I've given up no consideration. However many I want could be zero. I've given up nothing. I'm not bound in any way to do anything. Thus, in that consequence, I'm not giving up anything. I'm not giving up consideration. Therefore, it's no contract, however many I want. What, though, if I say, I'll buy widgets from you however many I require for my business? Would that be consideration? Yes. That is consideration. Because a requirement is unlike a want. A requirement is, if I need any widgets, if I'm going to buy any widgets, I've got to buy them from you. That commits me to some degree. I can't just forget about you and go buy widgets from somewhere else. If it's how many widgets I require, I got to buy them from you. Likewise, you might agree to sell me your total output of widgets. And someone might say, well, output of widgets is illusory consideration because you don't have to produce any. You're going to shut down your plant, stop producing. But that's not a good argument because it's assumed that you're making money from these widgets and that if you want to produce any widgets, make any money off widgets, you got to sell them to me. That's giving up something. It's giving up the right to produce widgets and sell them to somebody else. So that's consideration. It's a rare case where there's illusory consideration, but what's one thing a lawyer might do is scrutinize a contract very closely to see if there are any easy out clauses where a party doesn't give up any consideration, which could make it a non-contract, not a contract, and could get you out of the contract. It's not a contract if you're not bound or committed in some way to give up some form of detriment. There was a famous case, as in a lot of law books, involving Lady Duff Gordon, who I guess was a famous person back then. But anyway, a woman designed dresses and things and agreed with this fellow. Maybe it was another woman, I'm not sure. Anyway, the retailer was supposed to sell these dresses and was supposed to get a certain percentage. Well, the dressmaker wanted out of that contract, saying it was illusory consideration because the person selling dresses didn't promise to sell any. Right? They could just not do anything. So they said that was illusory consideration. The court said, no, that's not. That's real consideration. And it had a couple of rationales. But one rationale was it said there was an implied good faith duty to try and sell some, which we'll talk about later. There is a good faith duty in most contracts. Okay, so look for illusory consideration. How about adequacy of consideration? What if it's an unfair deal? Can you get out of a contract because, well, gee, the terms just aren't fair. The consideration is uneven. One side is a lot more, giving a lot more than the other side. Well, the general rule here is no, no, no. Courts aren't out there to make contracts fair, to make deals fair. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to make a fair deal for yourself. If you make a bad deal, don't look to a court to get you out of it. So courts don't look at adequacy of consideration. That's just generally the rule. If there's some consideration there on either side, some any consideration, that's all a court wants. Now, there are minor exceptions to that. Occasionally, it may look like a sham. You see a lot of contracts, you know, saying, in consideration for one penny, I hereby. Well, sometimes courts enforce those, although those look like that's not really consideration. That's just a sham. So those may be subject. Another adequacy of consideration issue is a doctrine called unconscionability. There's some contracts that are so extraordinarily unfair, a court won't enforce it, But that's a whole topic that's coming later, so I'm sorry. I'll have to ask to put that off for now. Exceptions to the consideration requirement? There are some times when consideration is not required. One I've already talked about. That was the case of the UCC and modification of an existing contract. That sort of modification of existing contract would violate the pre-existing duty rule. But the UCC says, no, we won't require consideration here. Another interesting one is a promise to perform a voidable duty. In other words, a promise to do something that you had a contract you had a right to void. Or pay a debt that has lapsed. This is kind of an interesting one. I'm not sure why the law made this exception, but it did. If I owe you $10,000, well, I keep promising to pay. I keep saying, oh, I'll pay you tomorrow. I'll pay you next Tuesday. You keep saying, okay, okay, I trust you. Okay, okay, I trust you. And I put you off and put you off and put you off until the statute of limitations has passed. And now you can't sue on your debt because the statute of limitations has gone by. It's too late for you to sue. But I feel guilty. Really. So I say, I promised, even though I know the statute of limitations has passed and I don't really have to pay you, I promise to pay you anyway. Well, different states have slightly different rules here, but some states require that I say that in writing, say. But the point is, that's a case where they will start the statute of limitations all over again and make me pay you that debt if I make that sort of promise, even after the statute of limitations is left. So be careful what you say. You make yourself into a new contract. Okay, that's it for the consideration topic. Got to move on now to capacity. We talked about how you have to have capacity to contract. I can't contract with your dog. But there are some more common circumstances here. The most probably hotly discussed capacity issue involves minors, which is people under 18. Now, one occasional misconception is the thought that parents are liable on contracts signed by their children. The general rule, though, is that is not the case, that parents are not liable for their children's contracts. That's why they may ask you to have your parent be a co-signer. That means you're both liable on the contract. But if there's none of this co-signer business on the contract, the parent isn't liable just because the kid entered into a contract. So let's say a minor makes a contract. What does that mean? Well, ordinary contracts are voidable. That means the minor can get out of the contract just by saying so. The voiding of a contract by a minor is known as disaffirming a contract. Disaffirming a contract. That's what a minor does to get out of a contract. And when a minor gets out of a contract, what must he do? Well, he has to give back the goods, but only in the condition that they're in. Consider the following. A youth, a minor, goes out and purchases a sports car. Why not a $100,000 plus Ferrari? Then he drives it to see how fast it will go. He discovers it will go very fast. And after he gets it up well into the 100s, he loses control, spins around, smashes into an abutment, ruins the car. Fortunately, he's safe. He was wearing a seatbelt. And so he says, what a shame. This car is ruined. I no longer want it. So he calls up the Ferrari dealership and says, by the way, did you know I was a minor? Because I'm a minor, I'm well aware of my legal rights. I believe I will disaffirm this contract. I want my money back. The Ferrari dealership says, ooh, that's bad. This is a problem. Okay, we know. We have to give you our money back, but you have to return that Ferrari. The minor says, by all means. You may scrape it off at the intersection of this highway and that highway, and it's all yours. And you know what? You can get away with it. I hope there are no minors watching this tape, because it could suggest to minors a lot of abusive behavior. I hope you don't tell your sons and daughters and little brothers and sisters about this, because it's problematic. Well, what does it mean functionally in the real world? It means that you should not make a contract with a minor. You would be out of your mind to do so under general circumstances if the minor can simply void the contract on a whim or for whatever reason. So that's why it's hard for minors to make contracts. And to tell you the truth, I suppose that a minor could go into a 7-Eleven or other similar store, buy a pack of gum, take a stick of gum, chew it up, wait until it has lost its flavor, and return it to the store and ask for a refund on the gum package. I don't think this has ever happened, and I doubt it would result in litigation. But as I understand the law, you could do that and get away with it. It's good to be a minor, right? Now, there are some limitations, though, on the rights of minors to get out of these things. One such limitation is what are called necessaries. Necessaries. A necessary is something that's necessary for a minor. Well, the general theory is that virtually nothing is necessary for a minor because their loving parents will take care of everything. But unfortunately today, loving parents aren't always the rule. And suppose a minor is emancipated, which essentially means they've moved out of home and they're on their own. In that case, an apartment, housing, is a necessary. They have to have some place to live. Food, if the parents are not providing food, if they don't have parents, food is a necessary. So if something is a necessary and the minor contracts for it, what's the law here? Well, the minor can still get out of this contract, but must return the full value received. So if my hypothetical minor who bought the Ferrari had found the Ferrari to be a necessary. Now, frankly, I cannot envision a set of circumstances where a Ferrari is a necessary. Perhaps it was necessary to the miner's business somehow. But if the Ferrari had been a necessary, what that means is the miner still could have disaffirmed the contract. But the miner would have had to return the whole value of the Ferrari, not just the smushed-up Ferrari. The miner would have had to return the smushed-up Ferrari plus whatever cash is the difference between a new and a smushed-up Ferrari. Quite a bit, I suspect. So that's if it's a necessary, but only if it's a necessary. A couple of other rules about minors. One is called ratification. Ratification. This is where you are not bound by a contract because you're a minor, but you say, well, even though I know I'm not bound, I want to keep the car, so I ratify the contract. So when a minor becomes of age, turns 18, the minor goes to the car dealer and says, I ratify your contract. Now that's like a real binding contract and the minor is bound. In fact, it is ratified if it is just not disclaimed after reaching the age. In other words, if the minor, after turning 18, doesn't go out and affirmatively disaffirm, that's probably not correct phrasing, but if the minor does not affirmatively disaffirm the contract within a short time after being 18, it will be deemed to be implicitly ratified, an implied ratification, and the minor is stuck with the contract. Okay, number four, lying about age. Here's another point. If the minor lies about the age, a lot of courts will force the minor to return full consideration. Again, the minor can get out of the contract. The minor can still disaffirm or void the contract, but must return full consideration. So, you know, if the guy who bought the Ferrari is a big strapping guy who looks like he could be 19 or 20 and he claims he's 19 or 20 and he's got his false ID, of course, saying he's at least 21, in that case, you sell him the car, you're more protected. He can disaffirm the contract, but he's got to return to you the full value of the Ferrari, not the smushed up Ferrari. Okay. Again, I caution these rules may vary by state, but these are the generally most common rules. Okay, second capacity issue is intoxication. Intoxication. What if you enter a contract when you're drunk? Can you get out of it? Probably not. Someone once said that alcohol is the grease for the wheels of commerce. A lot of deals are made over drinks. They used to be made over martinis. Now, today's world, you know, it may be wine, maybe carrot juice, but whatever. Just because you've had a few drinks doesn't mean you lack the capacity to contract. I mean, there's a famous Georgia case where these people were sitting up at night having fun with their neighbors, partying and drinking, scribbled out this little contract on a napkin that said, I agree to pay such and such money for this guy's piece of property. And then they both signed it. Well, the next day, the buyer wants the property. The seller says, no, I didn't really mean to make a contract. I mean, I was actually, he said he was high as a Georgia pine, which is pretty high. But it was a binding contract, even though it was scribbled out on a napkin. It was a binding contract because while he had had some drinks, he was not so severely incapacitated, intoxicated, that he did not know what he was doing. If you make a bad deal when you're drunk, I'm sorry, you're stuck with it. You should not have gotten drunk when you're making the contract. you have got to be so drunk that you don't even really know you're making a contract in order to get out of it on grounds of capacity. And that's the third type of capacity to talk about, mental incapacity, a similar rule. It must be severe. The mental incapacity must be severe to the point where the person virtually did not know what they were doing. You can't get out of a contract by modestly claiming to be sort of feeble-minded after the fact. It's mental incapacity must be severe to prevent a contract from becoming binding, to enable you to void the contract. Okay, time to move on to main topic three, form. And the form question here is the statute of frauds. The statute of frauds. Now, the statute of frauds does not literally have to do with fraud. I don't know why it's called that. The statute of frauds means that certain contracts have to be in writing. This is mainly for historic reasons, you know, not necessarily for any logical reason. And in fact, this whole idea of statute of frauds and contracts having to be in writing has been abandoned all over, including largely abandoned in England, where the whole thing started. But we've kept it here in America, by gosh. Certain types of contracts have to be in writing. Actually, the contract itself doesn't have to be in writing. There just has to be something in writing called a memorandum that states what the contract is. There has to be a writing for certain types of contracts. What are they? Land sales. The sale of land has to be in writing. If you're going to sell real estate, it has to be in writing to be binding. You make an oral agreement to sell real estate, it's worthless in most places because land sales have to be in writing. And this not only includes the sale of all interest in land, which for some unknown reason is called a fee simple, it also includes other major interests in land. It may include an easement or even a very long-term lease. If you have one of these co-ops where you have a 99-year lease, that may have to be in writing. A substantial interest in the sale of land has to be in writing, or it's no contract. You can get out of it. B, the sale of goods. Now, the UCC generally liberalizes contract rules, but here it's been strict. The UCC says a contract for the sale of goods valued at more than $500 must be in writing. If you want to buy goods more than $500, you have to put that in writing. So that's a fairly significant restriction. Now, the UCC also left a bit of an out, something of a loophole here, which was that accepted partial performance can get you out of the writing requirement, which means that if I agree to sell you 10 cars for so much money, but we do it orally, well, these 10 cars are worth more than $500, you know, $10,000, $100,000, whatever. I agreed to sell you these 10 cars, and we do it orally. Now, that contract is not enforceable because it violates the statute of frauds under the UCC. But suppose I send you those 10 cars, and you accept them. I mean, you sign the little form and take them onto your property. And then you later say, well, I really don't have to pay you because this isn't binding, because it wasn't in writing, and, you know, you can take your cars back for all I care. That would be an exception. Because you accepted my performance, that takes the place of a writing, and now it is a binding contract. But obviously, for safety's sake, you want to put these contracts in writing if they're over $500, or they may be unenforceable. For safety's sake, you probably want to put just about every contract in writing. I can think of little reason not to. It certainly makes it easier to prove your case, should there be a breach, should you have to sue on the contract. But if it's oral, most contracts you can at least still try to recover because it's on an oral contract to the testimony of witnesses. With some of these statute of frauds contract, land sale and sale of goods, you can't even try to recover. It's automatically no good if it's not in writing. Okay, another statute of frauds is called the one-year rule. The one-year rule. This is where a contract cannot conceivably be performed in less than a year. If a contract has to take more than a year to be performed by its terms, it has to be in writing. Which means that when, say, Derek Coleman of the Nets or Emmitt Smith of the Cowboys or some other star athlete signs a contract binding them for 5 years to their team, that has to be in writing to be enforceable. On the other hand, if the contract could be performed in less than a year, it can be oral. Doesn't even matter whether it is performed in less than a year. Doesn't even matter if it probably could be performed in less than a year. If it conceivably could be performed in less than a year, then it's oral. But if by its terms it takes more than a year, it has to be in writing. Okay, one more statute of frauds. This is an old one. It's not too common anymore, but it's always an interesting one. Promises in consideration of marriage have to be in writing. Promises in consideration of marriage. Now, I don't think this happens too much anymore, but I suppose it might in certain circles. I agree to pay you $10,000 if you marry me. Well, you accept. Well, that contract's got to be in writing to be enforceable. So if we make this orally, I say, I agree to pay you $10,000 if you marry me, you say, well, okay, I guess, you know, even marriage to you would, you know, would be okay under those terms. So so we get married, then she says, where's my $10,000? And I say, ha, you should have paid more attention in law. That was a contract in consideration of marriage, and it needs to be in writing, and it wasn't. So I don't have to pay you $10,000. Ha. But notice this only applies to contracts where marriage itself is the consideration. Thus, if, you know, we're talking about negotiating before a marriage, and my betrothed says to me, I promise to give up my mud wrestling career if you promise not to watch Sunday football. I say, okay. Well, that can be oral, because their marriage is not the consideration. There it's, you know, mud wrestling for football, this consideration. Yeah. So, okay, let's talk about some review cases. Let's take our minor case and look at it backwards. Suppose that I sell a contract to you. I'm a car dealer, and I sell you a contract, and you're a minor. And then, as you're leaving the lot, I think to myself, he was a minor. What am I doing? This is a terrible deal. I could be in big trouble. So I rush out to the minor and say, hey, I void that contract. I want out of that contract. Does that work? No. It's voidable, but it's voidable at the option of the minor. Okay? Well, here's a real case. A child was born. That's always nice. And the parents named the child after its grandfather. Fortunately, it was a boy. So, they're not that close with the grandfather, I guess. They don't tell him. They named after him but didn't tell him. Maybe they're just being clever. Because sometime later, the grandfather calls up the parents and promises to give the parents a parcel of real estate if they name the child after the grandfather. Pretty, which they've already done, right? So they say, we accept. Well, so that's all. Everyone's very happy. Well, but the grandfather dies. And the estate takes over and refuses to give the property to the parents. Well, I mean, they made a deal. Shouldn't they have to give the property? You didn't notice, estates are kind of tough, right? A lot of these cases were going along fine until somebody died and the estate took over. And these people, these executors or executrixes, as they call a woman administrator, they're very tough. They want to, you know, keep you to the letter of the law. So, The estate refuses to pay. Well, what's their theory? Their theory is there was no consideration. There was no consideration. Well, what do you say? That's right. He doesn't have to give the real estate. There was no consideration. They had given up nothing because they had already named the child after the grandfather at the time the contract was made. So they gave up no consideration. Actually, a really clever couple would have had an argument. Can you think of an argument the parents might have made to the court? I don't know if they did. They said, well, we would have changed his name. We would have changed his name but for this deal, you see. So we were auctioning this off to the highest grandfather. Now, if they could have claimed that colorably, you know, I suppose they might have been able to argue that there was consideration for not changing the name. To the best of my knowledge, they didn't make this argument. It didn't come up, but, you know, there is something of an argument there. So, in these consideration cases, you usually think about them. I mean, you can usually think of a way to make it a real complicated legal argument. It requires a lot of lawyers that, you know, charge you $100 an hour and make a lot of money as a consequence. Yeah, lawyers are pretty good at figuring out circumstances like that. Okay. Let's see here. How about this one? You owe $15,000... to MasterCard. You've been a little profligate in charging things to your MasterCard, and somehow you got a credit limit that was this high, $15,000 to MasterCard. Well, if you know how MasterCard works, as I think any good red-blooded American does, has one of these credit cards, they expect you to pay some small fraction of this every month, right? Really, quite a small fraction oftentimes, maybe a couple hundred dollars. So you send MasterCard a check for a couple hundred dollars, and you write, in full satisfaction of all debts due on that check. And then MasterCard cashes the check, and then they send you a bill for the remaining $14,700 or something, and you write them and say, I'm sorry, I believe we compromised this debt last month. I sent you that check, and you cashed it, and so I don't know the rest of this money. Well, I think you all know that's not going to work. Well, why is it not going to work? Well, there are actually probably several reasons why it's not going to work. One reason is there was no consideration for that reduction. In other words, MasterCard got nothing in exchange for reducing it by $14,700. Now, there would be a difference in this result. There would be an exception here if the entire bill was disputed. If you said, I don't owe any of that $15,000. All that $15,000 was run up by someone who stole my card or was forged or something like that. And if you have a real, you can't just say that, but if you have a real claim to that effect and you agree to pay $300 and MasterCard cashes it, that might deem to be a compromise under those circumstances. And that might extinguish the remainder of your debt. But under the ordinary course of events, this is not an unliquidated debt. There is no reasonable grounds for disputing that you owed $15,000. I mean, you spent the money, let's face it. So under those circumstances, this sort of compromise is not going to get you out of the remainder of the debt. Okay, another case. Let's say someone saved your life. That's nice, right? Someone saved your life, and you're so thankful to this person for saving your life, you promise him you were firstborn. Then you forget about it for a while, and after you have a child, he comes back and tries to claim it. Do you owe him your firstborn? Do you have a contract? No. Well, suppose it wasn't your firstborn. Suppose it was, after he saved your life, you say, I'm so grateful to you. I'm so tremendously grateful to you. I'll give you $15,000 as soon as I can raise it. And you do raise $15,000. You start thinking to yourself, well, hey, it wasn't all that great a rescue. I mean, he kind of strained my back, and somebody else probably would have done it, so I don't want to pay him $15,000. Do you have to? No. The rescuer gave up no consideration. The rescuer gave up nothing of detriment. You may be thinking, well, of course he did. He dived into the water. He risked his life. But he did that before you offered to pay him. So it was not a bargained for detriment. Sure, he risked his life, but he did not do that to bargain for this $15,000. You offered him the $15,000 after he'd already completed the rescue. Well, I suppose it could be different. I mean, you're out there drowning, and you could have rescuers standing on the pier saying, I'll do it for 20. And then, you know, then you might have a real contract, and you could say, I accept and all that. But under the facts I gave you, the answer is no. That is not the case. Okay, one more minor case. Here's a kid who, his parents love him. He's happy at home, but he gets angry at his parents. Sometimes that happens, right? Kids get a little bit angry at their parents. And he moves out, and he rents an apartment. And makes his deposit, and he lives in the apartment for a month. At the end of the month, he doesn't pay his rent. He says, I miss mommy. So he goes home. So the apartment complex says, well, at least we have his deposit wrong. The miner, knowing his rights under the law, calls up and says, I want my deposit back, please. And the apartment says, well, you didn't pay your rent. We get to keep your deposit. The miner says, no, I don't think so. I'm a miner. I can void my contracts. I can get out of my contracts. I get my deposit back. This case depends on whether the apartment was a necessary. If the apartment was a necessary, the miner must pay for the fair value he received, which would be the deposit and maybe a little bit more in rent. But if it was not a necessary, the miner doesn't have to pay anything. In this case, The court held it was not unnecessary because the minor always had a loving home there to go to. He did not need an apartment. It was not unnecessary, which means that the apartment keeps nothing, has to give him back $150. So the dangers of dealing with minors, I warn you. Okay, that's it for this topic. Thank you.